You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord stage talk about extremism on digital gaming platforms. This week we're joined by Rachel Coward and Linda Schlegel to talk about extremism in gaming communities. Together they published a book that brings together a range of insights from world-leading experts in the field of gaming and extremism. And during the talk, we'll talk about everything from radicalization to prevention methods, and from Call of Duty to real-world violence. You can find all of the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Mehdal Zut, on Thursday the 20th of June in the Bellingcat Discord server. Welcome to this week's Bellingcat Discord stage talk. This week we're joined by Rachel Coward and Linda Schlegel to talk about extremism on digital gaming platforms, such as Discord. I'll first quickly introduce myself because it's my very first time hosting a stage talk. My name is Mehdal Zut. My colleague Charlie is on a well-deserved break this week, which is I'm taking over. Let me introduce you to our guest. Rachel Coward is a research psychologist who specializes in the uses and effects of digital games. She's also the founder of Psychgeist, a multimedia content production studio for the science of games and pop culture. Currently, she is working as one of the primary investigators on the first grant-funded project from the Department of Homeland Security about games and extremism. And then we have Linda Schlegel. She is a research fellow at the Center for Applied Research on De-Radicalization. She also works as a fellow at the Peace Research Institute in Frankfurt and is one of the founding members of the Extremism and Gaming Research Network. I'm excited to hear about your work in this field, and I'll first give the stage to Rachel, who will speak about radicalization in the gaming spaces. And next, we'll give the stage to Linda, who will add on to this by adding some prevention efforts. After the talks, there's time for a Q&A. You can ask your questions in the chat. Please point out in your question if you do not want me to read out your name for privacy reasons. All right, let's get started. Let's give the stage to Rachel.
Thank you for that great introduction. Hi, everyone. I'm going to do my best to be brief because I find that the Q&A is actually the best part of these conversations. But I do want to create a little bit of context around this field that Linda and I have been exploring for the last several years. Games and extremism, it is a growing area of interest. It is also a wide field with a lot of different interests within it. We have people from psychology and political science and communication science and conflict studies, and you get a little bit of everyone from everywhere. And their interest also lies in different parts of this umbrella, whether it's radicalization, recruitment, propaganda material, which is part of recruitment, but also prevention, which is what Linda's going to talk about. So I feel like I'm a little bit different in this field in that I came from game studies and moved into studying extremism in games versus someone who studied extremism and terrorism and then moved into games. I read the 2019 report from the Anti-Defamation League that said 1 in 4 game players are exposed to white supremacist ideology online. And when I read that, it was really shocking to me as someone who'd played games my whole life. Even for me, 1 in 4 seemed like a really high proportion. And I called up Daniel Kelly, who wrote the report, and I was like, you did your stats wrong. And he was like, I did them right. It's bad. And I was like, oh, that's scary. And so that's when I pivoted my work into this area. And as Meryl mentioned, I'm one of the primary investigators on the Department of Homeland Security funded work, in which we were tasked with essentially landscaping extremism in games. Like, what does it look like? What is the prevalence? What is like the flavor of the day? And what do we know about the ways in which these spaces are being intentionally infiltrated in a way, like intentionally used for mobilization or communication for designated terror groups, but also what are the vulnerabilities in this space for kind of the unintentional amplification or normalization of extremist ideology, which is really where my specific area of interest lies, is looking at kind of what is the landscape of games and what makes them unique in the online landscape in terms of being able to be used this way for radicalization and recruitment and mobilization. Now, before I turn it over to Linda, I just want to mention one piece of my work that I've been doing in the last couple years that I find interesting, and maybe you do too. And it's looking at this idea of identity fusion. So one of the really interesting things about games is that friendships form different in games than they do on other online platforms. Because typically when you meet someone, you slowly get to know them and slowly learn if you can trust them. But in games, these relationships are essentially emotionally jump-started. You have a foundational level of trust that begins at the beginning. Do you help me kill this dragon? I like you. I know nothing about you, but you helped me do this task in this game. And now I have this foundational level of trust. And that can emotionally jumpstart the closeness that you feel with other people in the gaming space. And research has found that this is being specifically leveraged for radicalization purposes. But what I found really interesting about friendship formation in games is it also lends itself to fostering this gamer identity. We have a lot of social identities. You know, I'm a baker. I'm a whatever. I like to read books. I like to see movies, or I'm a gamer. And these identities are separate from our individual identity. They're usually like, I am Rachel, I am a gamer. They're different boxes. But identity fusion is this psychological concept that talks about when these identities become fused together. And the best example is military identities. My father was a Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. Like, there's no tearing out Marine identity and identity of my father as like John. So we did some work with the University of Texas, and we looked at identity fusion among game players, and we found a couple things. One, that identity fusion with gaming and gamer identity does exist, can exist, and can be measured and documented. But the other thing is that people who have this fused identity reflect the extreme cultures and the normalization of hate and harassment and misogyny and racism that we see in gaming spaces. So gamers with a fused identity were more likely to say they've had recent aggressive behavior. They were more likely to register on low measures of low empathy, on racism. They're more likely to overtly endorse the tenets of white nationalism. And we didn't see that with non-fused players. So this is kind of my area. Like, okay, well, if we're seeing this reflect the culture, how can we then change the culture of gaming spaces? And what does that look like from a psychological perspective, but also from a perspective of someone who interfaces a lot with the gaming industry? So it's like, what can we see from the industry side? And then with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Linda.
Thank you, Rachel. So just like Rachel is sort of coming from game studies, I'm coming at this from a different angle. My background is in radicalization research and prevention work. So I'm mostly interested in how can we twist this around? We know that sort of extremists are using digital gaming spaces and video games in various ways. They're producing their own games, they're modding, they're using gaming and game adjacent platforms. They've used sort of visuals from video games, like ISIS incorporated Call of Duty footage in their propaganda videos, that type of thing. So they're trying really hard to sort of exploit the popularity of gaming and gaming spaces and everything that comes with gaming culture. But we also already have research on positive effects of video games and of gaming spaces, including positive effects on the social aspects, how you behave towards others, your attitudes towards outgroups, perspective taking, all that kind of stuff that you would like people to take away from these video games. We also have research on that. But the narrative right now, particularly in the media, is very negative. It's like, oh my God, video games are dangerous. And we've already had that in the 90s, right? After Columbine, it's like, oh my God, everyone who plays first-person shooters is a potential school shooter, which obviously isn't the case. And so I'm trying to work on not falling into that trap again and not letting the discourse be super negative. We need to be very aware of what's going on in digital gaming spaces in terms of radicalization, in terms of extremist content. Rachel did work on mobilization and recruitment. We need to know all this stuff. We need to be aware of that. But then we also need to ask sort of what can we do to prevent that, and how can we use gaming spaces in a positive way? And that's sort of my focus, and there are different ways of going about this. I'm just going to quick fire some things, and then in the Q&A we can maybe go into a little more depth. So one thing that we've been doing from the research side is obviously awareness raising, trying to bring all the stakeholders on the same page and at the same table with the Extremism and Gaming Research Network that Rachel and I are both part of. We try to sort of facilitate a dialogue with international organizations, police forces, but also gaming platforms and gamers themselves to just sort of get a common ground and try to kickstart some sort of cooperation in terms of trying to prevent this and trying to counteract radicalization in gaming spaces. Obviously, there is a policy aspect, although a lot of the digital policies do not explicitly name gaming and gaming adjacent spaces, like social media platforms, for instance, are regulated now. in the gaming sphere, it's less so. So there's something that we could play with on a policy level. We have obviously the platforms themselves, community guidelines, moderation, sort of reactive measures taken by the platforms. That differs a lot per platform that we're talking about, but generally could be improved, I would say. And I believe Rachel also interviewed some of these sort of platform hosters who said, well, we don't even know where to start. We don't really know what to do. We don't have the tools. So that's something that we could be looking at in terms of prevention. Then we could also look at gamers and users themselves, obviously, sort of bottom-up approaches to prevention. And that starts really with flagging this kind of stuff. And that's already where the problem starts, because rarely do people flag extremist content in digital gaming spaces. We did a study for UNOCT, interviewed over 500 gamers, and they said, no, we don't flag stuff. We just leave. We don't even engage these people. We don't flag. We don't do anything. We just leave. So that means we have a problem, because we don't even know where this type of content is most prevalent, because we cannot police all these different spaces. So that's something that we could be talking about in terms of bottom-up approaches. What could we do to sort of engage gamers, empower them to take charge of their own discursive spaces and do something against extremism? And then lastly, which is my area of expertise, is sort of professional prevention work, often implemented by civil society organizations, sometimes state actors, but less so. It's usually stuff that is aimed to bring out a positive aspect, to raise awareness, to increase resilience, but also to offer support to victims of hate. And there are different ways of going about this. We see a lot of bespoke video games being produced from prevention actors right now to sort of combat hate in a digital game that they produced for this specific purpose of educating audiences against extremism. However, not too many people play this in their free time, often because there is not enough budget to make this a really cool game. So it feels very educational a lot of times. So it's not really working the way it's intended to at the moment. There's also some initiatives sort of on platforms like digital youth work, people who are trying to go into these spaces, into the chats, into the forums, and try to talk to potentially at-risk gamers about sort of the prevention space, and, you know, redirect them to other sources, try to engage them in some sort of way. And then we've also seen sort of gaming references being used in some video formats or in some other content. Just like ISIS used Call of Duty footage, prevention actors try to reproduce the visual aspects of video games to just make their content more appealing. Because, to be honest, a lot of the content right now in prevention is kind of lame. So using video game aesthetics would be one way to make it more appealing and use something that's so popular to sort of bring prevention space into the forefront. In the future, we could also talk about sort of modding. That might be easier than producing your own games. We could talk about what else could be done on platforms, live streaming, influencers, working with esports teams is something that hasn't been explored, but that I think might be very cool to do and reach a lot of people. And then, of course, sort of cooperation with the platforms. Right now, there is really a disbalance. There's not really a connection between prevention actors and platform hosters. So there's kind of a mismatch that we need to bridge in the future. But generally speaking, I think I always end every talk with gaming is really an opportunity to increase our prevention work, to make it more appealing, and to use the positive aspects of gaming that so many of you know and like and love, also for like democratic work, let's say. And with that, I think I'll give back to Meryl.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the great introduction to your work. I see a lot of questions coming in the chat, so we can just start with that right away. TZ18 asks, how much does it just come down to unmoderated/self-moderated spaces?
I saw that question, and I'm curious, what do you mean, how much does it come down to? Like, why is it so prevalent? I mean, because the spaces that we're looking at are spaces that are, in theory, meant to be moderated in some way. At the very least, they have terms of service and code of conduct. But like Linda said, a lot of people don't report the things that they see because it has become a normalized kind of part of the culture and not necessarily seen as something that's meant to be reported. You have something to add?
I would just say that reactive measures are usually not enough when you're trying to prevent extremism in the long term. So that might help in the short term in sort of deleting violent content, but then we often only delete the violence, right? And then what we're left with is sort of the inspiring utopian narratives that extremist organizations put out there. So we also need proactive measures to counter the appeal of that and not just sort of deleting. It is helping extremists, I think, if there isn't enough content moderation, but I'm not sure that's sort of the only way to go about this is to increase moderation efforts.
Yeah, actually, that reminds me. I did a study a couple years ago in conjunction with Gamer Safer and Middlebury looking at private Minecraft servers. And we were looking at the prevalence of hateful kind of extremist language across servers. And what we found is that the code of conduct and the policy that set the culture for the space was when it was more specific and more actionable, that was a better predictor of there being kind of less levels of this toxicity or whatever you want to call it in the space than moderation efforts. So it wasn't the servers with more moderators that were like less extreme. It was the servers that had better, clearer public policy. So there is a lot to be said about the bottom up kind of self-moderating, setting the culture of your individual spaces in terms of the power there for kind of changing the norms.
Thank you. I see some other questions coming in about moderation. Do you see any examples of what is already being done in this space? What progress do you see? That's a question that Rogue State is asking.
There's a lot of progress that I'm seeing in the industry. One example I'll give is Activision, Call of Duty, which is often the example. They recently changed their policy of their code of conduct to include the phrase, the amplification of hateful language, which I think was a really big step in the right direction. I think a lot of times people hide under this guise of normality or, oh, it's funny, or I didn't know. And so it doesn't become actioned when they start to spread extremist ideologies. And they also enacted voice moderation, preventive voice moderation. Like there's a slight delay and it is like muting things before they're broadcast to everybody in the space. And I think that that's a really great change that we're seeing.
I would add Twitch to that. We see a progression in terms of attack live streams. The Halo attacker tried to stream his attack. It took 20 minutes for Twitch to block it. And then during the Buffalo shooting, it took them only 2 minutes to block the live stream. So we see a real progression there in terms of extremist content. We also see more and more gaming platforms or gaming-related organizations joining like the Global Internet Forum to counter terrorism. And they have sort of transparency reports. They have what is called a hash database where they flag extremist content with like a code. And then you can go on your own platform and look for this specific type of content that has been flagged elsewhere. So there are all these progress being made, but it's all voluntary, right? So not every platform is participating in that.
Yeah, could you talk a bit more about those terrorist live streams and how they've been repurposed by the far right in games and what have been done to remove those?
I think the question is about sort of the how you can reenact attacks within games, right? We see that a lot in terms of modding. There are efforts to take them down. Roblox took down Russian propaganda that has sort of used the Ukrainian war in some Roblox games. But it's kind of like a needle in a haystack trying to moderate these types of content. So there's definitely progress in that area too, but more to be done, particularly in sort of mod forums themselves, who usually don't participate in anything that I just mentioned. And there we see actually a lot of this type of content being produced and being played and then shared in like private chat groups and distributed through other channels that we don't even see overtly. So it's very difficult to take a hold of that and delete all of this.
And then we have a question that Glib is asking. He's long wanted to know why Xbox is considered more racist, possibly more radical than PlayStation. Does this claim have any real basis in your experience, and what is the reason behind it, if so?
Sounds like a question for Rachel.
In my experience, I have not seen research to support that any one place is more. A good kind of parallel I can draw is that Roblox is often given as the example for where kind of awful things are happening, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's happening more in Roblox. We might just have more insight, like they have an open API, like we might just have more insight into what's happening in those spaces. But in the work that I've done, in the work that I've seen, there has not been any clear kind of differentiation set between platforms as having more or less. It's really just everywhere.
Yeah, and I think consoles are particularly difficult to research as well, because you need the equipment, right? If you're researching Steam, you can just log on and look at the forums. But if you're playing a console, and it's particularly if it's voice-based communication, it's very difficult to research. And I too don't know any research on that in particular.
The next question is from Sleepy Pant, who's asking, de-radicalization is a very specific field. How do we help to promote it? And is there a way of fellow gamers can spot and promote de-radicalization tactics? So this is kind of that bottom-up approach that you previously mentioned, Linda.
Yeah, I think we would need initiatives that are coordinated as well as sort of individual gamers taking initiative, right? It would already be helpful to have some sort of counter speech, but if you do that, you are putting yourself on the spot, right? Then you could be the target of hate. That's why it's always good to have some sort of backing, like we had on other social media platforms, the hashtag I am here, maybe you've heard about that, where people just go in sort of swarms into the comment section and try to be more positive. So that, I think, would be really helpful. But also, like I said, just the basic thing, flagging stuff, helping us identify where this work is needed, that would already be a huge contribution that every gamer can make in this space and can help us do the de-radicalization work. I do agree that it's rather specific, and I don't think sort of lay people have an easy time trying to de-radicalize someone. What we would need is points of contact and more information on who you could contact if you think someone in a digital gaming space is potentially radicalizing or is sharing beheading videos or whatever it might be, to not just flag them to the platform and have him or her deplatformed, but to also flag that to a prevention practitioner to say, here, someone might be radicalizing, can you take a look? So we would need that, and we would need the help of the platforms to do that, to have some sort of area that everyone can access. You know, here's just some information on prevention practitioners you can contact.
The social psychologist in me wants to see something, say something. Just reiterating what Linda said, it's important to report, but also from the research, we know that the best way to stop these kinds of actions from happening in the moment is someone of a similar social status who say something and when they see something. So if somebody's saying something really racist or really misogynistic or really awful, and they sound like a male sounding voice, another male sounding voice being like, hey, actually that's not cool, or something to that effect, actually deflates the situation in the moment. So I think that on a mass scale would start to make culture shifts about what's accepted and what's not in these spaces. And that is an important step every day.
All right. The next question is by Galen, who says that he would imagine that games with violent themes are more likely to grow into forums for radicalization and extremism. Is that the case? And are there any recurring features of games that often co-occur with radicalization?
I'll let you talk about the violence aspect. Okay. I think you're the expert on that. Okay. Are there reoccurring themes? We did this UNOCT study, and gamers themselves reported certain characteristics that they said they felt made it more likely that a game hosts hateful content. That's if it has a large player base, if you have to play with strangers, it's player versus player and not just against the computer, and it's voice-based, which is difficult to moderate. And these are sort of characteristics that may make it more likely that hateful content occurs. Other than that, there is some sort of weird obsession, at least for right-wing extremists, with historical war games. So yes, that's part of it. but I wouldn't say that sort of the content of the game necessarily correlates with the radicalization potential, if you will, because we also see it in Roblox, and Roblox is like a Lego type of visual, right? That has nothing to do with war and violence. But Rachel, to you.
She wants to have on a soapbox a little. You know, there's no causal link between playing violent video games and committing real world violence. We know that from decades and decades of research. It's a misnomer. But what I like to talk about in terms of content, because a lot of times the question comes up about content because the focus is on kind of military sims, is that the content is the mood music for the radicalization. It's really about the social environment. It's really about the people. Yes, the mood music can enhance the mood or make it more amenable to have these conversations, but it's not required as a space for radicalization to occur. And I haven't seen evidence, like hard objective evidence, that it more likely happens in games with violent themes. It just happens everywhere. It's just a perception, perhaps, that it happens more in these spaces. Or these spaces are already more the target of people's attention when it comes to other studies in and around games and their uses and effects.
Yeah, and that's an important research gap, right? So in the future, I'm sure we're going to see studies looking at sort of extremist groups on certain gaming platforms, and then sort of the list of games that they play and try to find some sort of correlation. But even then, it's not a causation. It's just sort of indicating what games are most popular in these social circles.
EXEQZ also asked a question about the genres, but also asked which people are targeted more, whether children or teenagers are more subject to these extremist ideologies on gaming platforms.
It's a really important question, and I'm glad you asked it, because there's different ways to look at it. One, younger people may be more susceptible to the messaging. They may be more impressionable. They may be more looking for peer validation, right? But older people have means and money, like adults, not older people, like adults over 18. From the case studies that we've seen, I've only seen a very small amount of case studies. They have focused specifically on teenagers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are being disproportionately targeted. I would think, Linda, please confirm or deny, I would think that different groups are being targeted for different reasons, whether it's more identity formation and kind of people mobilization versus like resources and actually enacting hateful acts.
Yeah, and in general, radicalization is a youth phenomenon, by and large, from the data that we have. It's usually young males between the ages of, let's say, 13, 14, and maybe their late 20s, who are the most susceptible to radicalization by far. In general, regardless of whether we're talking gaming or offline radicalization or something else. And I agree that it sort of depends, because particularly in the gaming space, we always think of young people, right? And that might be true if we think of Roblox, which has 60% of its users under the age of 17 and something like 20% under the age of 9. So there, if we have extremist content there, we can say, yes, this is disproportionately targeting very young kids. But on other gaming platforms, I mean, the average gamer is, what, 35 or something? So it's not necessarily just young people who come into contact with this.
And we've been talking a lot about racism and violence stemming from gaming, but Sarah is asking if there have been any effective efforts to counter the widespread sexism as well.
I wish. No. I haven't seen widespread efforts actually to really combat any of these kind of flavors of what I would consider extremist language. I did a landscaping study a year or two ago, and I use these graphs a lot, so it's fresh in my mind, where it's like misogyny, 98% of people have witnessed it in games. Racism is like 95. White nationalism is like 85. Like, these things are all so incredibly prevalent. I have not seen any concerted effort or united effort to kind of remove this content from these spaces. Although I do want to make the point that it is, none of this is unique to games, right? Like, misogyny is everywhere. Racism's everywhere. But what I find from the cultural perspective about games is games reflect culture, but they also create culture. So there is something to be said about the normalization in these spaces. There is some power to it being normalized in these spaces specifically, but also it's not unique to games as compared to just like the world.
But I think a lot of gamers, female gamers, report that type of hateful content. And yeah, I don't think there are concerted efforts to approach that. And it's also, it is related to radicalization, but it's just one of several elements, and it's not necessarily the most important one in a lot of spaces. So yeah, but that doesn't mean it you know, we shouldn't also be working towards preventing sexism. But I think it's so prevalent in gaming spaces, like you say, it's everywhere.
The next question is, how do we draw a distinction between people in game role playing versus the actual spread of extremist content?
The problem. That's what makes moderation so tricky. Also, people often say, like, why don't you just report when someone is, like, grooming you for sexual exploitation or grooming you for violence? And it's like, because it feels like making a friend. Who's going to report someone's being nice to me and I feel like I'm making a friend? Nobody. And that's what makes it really difficult. It's hard to distinguish. And when you have kind of loose open rules, like, you know, this is a place where you can say anything and speech is free and role play welcome, and that it makes it exponentially more difficult to kind of tease that apart, which is why, you know, you can't rely on wordless moderation, or you can't just rely on AI moderation, because people saying I'm gonna kill you on Call of Duty is a totally in context thing that you can say that should not be flagged or necessarily moderated. So it's really challenging.
Yeah, and extremists don't start with like the super hardcore violent extremist content in any case, right? We call this soft pill type of content, where it's like maybe it's an anti-Semitic joke. You know, it's just sort of testing the water. Is someone receptive to that type of content? And then sort of slowly adding on to that. It's not someone going in being like, hey, do you want to join a jihadist organization? That's not how this works. So it's a process, and it's kind of like you don't really realize maybe what's going on and in which direction you're going. We had some teenagers arrested in Germany, and they reported that. They were like, oh, we're just sort of making friends, and they were also cool. And then they asked us to do a Hitler salute, and we did because we wanted to fit in, and they didn't really realize where this was going. So that's the other problem with that.
Now we have a question from Chrissy, who asks, how can we ensure that people in gaming communities are not being unfairly reported? Based on this report, there have been talks on how marginalized game community members have been unfairly reported and banned.
My initial response would be, if flagging is this rare, we have a different problem that needs to be solved in the first place, and then we can talk about falsely flagging. But first, people need to be more aware and be more willing to flag in general. I don't really have a good answer for sort of false flagging.
I do not either.
That's also an answer.
Yeah. We need more answers. Yeah.
Fair enough. We have a question. It's by Squirrel, and she asks, have you identified events which have been used by the far right as recruitment drives, like Gamergate in gaming, and what the commonalities of such events may be? How can they be identified?
How they can be identified. There is a clear link between Gamergate and how that amplified recruitment efforts and kind of normalized the playbook for recruitment efforts. There's a great talk. I'm going to try to find it here in a minute. I'm going to pass to Linda. I'm going to Google furiously. There's a great talk from Constance Steinkuhler from Games for Change last year, where she essentially laid that out. She has a really nice graphic about how Gamergate set the playbook for a lot of the extremist content and radicalization that we're seeing in gaming. I'm going to try to find that.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, Gamergate 1 was the start of sort of the alt-right, the alternative right-wing extremism. They sort of met through Gamergate, for a lack of a better word. So it's definitely related. I would say in general, right-wing extremists in particular try to jump on any type of current event that they can exploit. And whether that's, you know, within the gaming sphere, like it was in Gamergate, or whether that's, you know, a young girl was being raped in Germany, for instance, by migrants, they would try to use that as well. Any type of current event, they would try to incorporate in their propaganda and to twist the narrative in their favor. Can you identify this? I think it's very difficult. You can be very sure that whatever happens is going to show up in your data if you're monitoring right-wing extremist channels. If it suits them, it's definitely going to show up there. I don't know how to stop that, but it's definitely something that we see a lot.
And could you maybe, for the people that are not familiar with this, elaborate a bit on what Gamergate is?
Silvergate was a coordinated harassment campaign in 2014. It was a political movement, guys under a philosophical stance of we want better ethics in games journalism, which was really kind of a smokescreen to just really publicly and terribly harass a lot of prominent women in gaming spaces, which led to online harassment, which led to offline harassment. And its effects can still be felt today. Kezia McDonald at The Guardian wrote a really great piece on it this year, kind of like looking back and to see how things have changed since Gamergate of 2014, 10 years ago. And the spoiler is not much, if not worse.
Thank you. And all the links and sources that are being mentioned in the talk will be put in the description of the podcast as well for the listeners that are not here live. Please put your questions in the chat. I'll continue with the one from Shucky Ducky, who asks, to what extent do larger gaming communities that span across multiple games, such as those originating from platforms like Something Awful, Reddit, 4chan, or Kiwi Farms, play a role in cultivating or spreading extremist ideologies? How do these cross-game communities compare to game-specific groups in terms of their potential influence on extremist attitudes or behaviors?
Really good question that we do not have an answer to empirically yet. It's something that we definitely need to look into. I would say there's a lot of overlap. We did just a few months ago, we did an exploration of like 20 platforms, and Reddit was definitely among one of the worst that we saw. But a lot of the hateful content that we saw wasn't directly related to gaming. So there is an overlap between Reddit communities and gaming communities, but they don't usually go to the gaming's Reddits, to the subreddits, to talk about extremist content because they have other outlets. So to sort of untangle that web, who is part of both types of groups and how do they interact, is something that research hasn't uncovered yet. And that's a very interesting question, a very relevant question that I don't have an answer to yet.
It's a great question because it highlights the fact that it's an ecosystem. I think that games, we're pretty clear that games are often a first stop to where this contact is made. And then they spread into these other places. Not to say that first contact can't happen other places, it certainly can, but a lot of first contact is happening in games under the guise of, hey, you helped me do this thing, aren't we cool? Hey, do you know of this like really niche Reddit board that I find awesome, right? And we see that kind of off-ramping that way. But yeah, that would be a really difficult empirical question to tease out, but does highlight the need for understanding kind of the ecosystem versus these spaces in isolation.
And then Hershey Maple asks, when thinking about online countering violent extremism, we always have to consider the online versus offline activity. Addressing the ideological radicalization is important, but without translating it into offline violence, it can be difficult to measure the efficacy of intervention methods. They say gaming adjacent platforms like Discord facilitating that transition from online to offline activity. If that hypothesis is true, what can be done to discourage online radicalization to become offline, real violence?
Another very good and very complicated question. So in general, ideological radicalization, as this person called it, or what we say cognitive radicalization, is much more common than violent radicalization. So a large part of people who radicalize will never go and perpetrate a violent act. It's a tiny fraction that will go on to actually do something like that. How do we reach these people? Well, the first question is, how do we identify them? And in the online sphere, it can be very difficult to identify them. While we know that a lot of attackers are sort of spilling their plans before they are actually perpetrating an attack, we also see a lot of people who are just talking a lot of blah, blah online and pretend they are going to do something which they would never do in real life. So to sort that out, is very difficult. And again, it would rely on people flagging that to some sort of authority or the platform for us to intervene. So it's a very difficult question. I'm not sure in how far we could really say it's purely online content facilitating also offline action. That's something that in radicalization research we're still sort of playing with. We know that this hard online-offline distinction is no longer viable in our lives because everyone is chronically online. We all know that. but sort of what does it take for someone to go from being in an extremist Discord server, for instance, to then go onto the streets and beat someone up? That step is so individual that we're still trying to figure out what triggers that type of action. So very good question. I'm so sorry to say this again, but I don't have a good answer to that.
So, you know, it's a good question. It's the questions we need to still research. But when you mentioned that, Linda, it reminded me of the study of the German teenagers who were radicalized that you mentioned earlier. They met on Roblox. They met this person who helped them do something. They thought they were cool. They said, join my Discord of other cool people. They joined the Discord. The Discord was populated with people who are already radicalized. And they slowly asked them to do more things offline. So they asked them to do the Hitler salute, which they did. Then they asked them to go offline and commit real world violence, which they did not. And then they went to the police. So like for them, there was a line there. They did already do some offline behavioral actions, which in Germany, doing the Hitler salute is illegal, right? Like that's a significant offense. But they drew the line at, you know, I think it was like go in the street and punch somebody in the face or something. So understanding, you know, what does it take to cross that line, I think is really important.
And if we're talking about that transition between online extremism and offline violence, this might be a relevant question. Geist asked, has there been any research done into VR communities or Discord as a third place for radicalization specifically?
The Institute for Strategic Dialogue has some pieces, I think. Do you know of any, Linda?
We've done just a very quick peek during our exploration of different platforms into like the meta, whatever it's called, the VR meta thing. I don't know. Oh God, I'm gonna get roasted tomorrow if I tell that my team I didn't remember the name of that. But we did a very quick peek into this sort of virtual reality world. And we saw a lot of things reflected that we also saw in writing on other platforms. So a lot of racism and targeted hatred. But because it is sort of also voice-based, it's very difficult to even take track of that, right? To even note that down, to make data from it. So we just took a very quick peek. I don't know if there's a lot of research on virtual reality yet. There are some theoretical pieces on the metaverse and what might happen in terms of extremism. I can post that as well. One of our colleagues has pieces on that. But I think that's sort of something to watch for the future, the virtual reality space.
Then our next question is, I understand that bottom-up and preventive tactics would work to change extremist audiences. Can you go further into digital policies that governments might take? Also, how do you persuade close-minded actors who are spreading hate?
Those are two different questions, big questions. I think policy certainly has its place. If we're going to start talking about digital spaces, you know, and starting to overcome the amount of social interaction we're having as compared to like traditional offline spaces, right? We saw it during COVID, or even, you know, I for sure spend more time talking to people online than I do offline in my daily life. We're going to have to start to talk about what does policy look like and what's the room for that. There was a piece that was published by the ADL a couple years ago where they asked gaming companies about their policies on extremist content specifically. They reached out to like 12 or 14 companies, and only one even explicitly talked about extremism in their policy. So I think that at least moving forward in the recognition that policy is needed and important is the first step. You know, the game industry is 20 years behind social media in talking about and understanding the role of extremism in their spaces. And we're starting to catch up. You know, we see the U.S. House and Senate starting to ask questions, like we're starting to catch up. But my concern with policy is making sure that it is tailored to games and not just taking what we know about social media and throwing it onto games, because all the scary bits about games are also all the best bits about games. So we have to figure out, like, where is the balance here? With governmental policy and regulation as compared to these preventative bottom-up measures or these measures coming from the industry itself, who likely have a better touch point on like what works and what doesn't in their space than a governmental regulator would.
Yeah, I agree. And we're seeing sort of more interest from policymakers on all different levels, definitely. EU Internet Forum, EU Commission on a European level, they're very interested in sort of the gaming space and have talked to platforms, have talked to prevention practitioners, have talked to researchers about this. So I believe there will be something coming in the future because the problem is being recognized. But I agree with Rachel, we need to be very careful with what we're doing to not go overboard, particularly because there is quite some backlash from parts of the gaming community. So keep politics out of gaming. We want nothing to do with this. Gaming isn't a political activity. We don't want to be regulated. This is a free space. It's our leisure time, that kind of thing. And sometimes very aggressively. And so we need to sort of be very careful in how we frame things and that we don't portray gaming as inherently dangerous or gamers as inherently at risk of radicalization on the policy level. So yeah, lots of things to do in the future, but I think there too, lots of things are currently happening.
Our next question is from Shucky Ducky, who asked, since the October 7th attacks and subsequent military operation in Gaza, there's been a noticeable increase in both pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian messaging on social media platforms. Have you observed similar trends within gaming communities? If so, to what extent do these appear to be individual expressions versus organized efforts? How do researchers distinguish between spontaneous individual actions and coordinated campaigns in these spaces?
Another great question. We can't really distinguish right now. It's very difficult to understand, particularly because of a lot of extremism nowadays isn't tied to a particular organization. A lot of it is sort of free-floating networks of radicalized individuals who are not swearing allegiance to this group or that group in particular. So it's very difficult to judge what is a coordinated action and what is just a bunch of individuals expressing their opinion. We have definitely seen an increase in anti-Semitism and also anti-Israel propaganda or comments, and also on the other side against Palestinians in the gaming space. I think in general, this goes back to the first point that Rachel made earlier, that gaming spaces are discursive spaces for the whole of society. So everything that is being discussed in general is being discussed in gaming spaces and is being fought over in gaming spaces. And this is not an exception. So yeah, we definitely see Gaza as one of the prominent themes right now.
The next question is from L. Werewolf, who asks, has there been any research done on how to effectively reach younger /gamer audiences, specifically with this messaging? Sometimes these kind of interventions, like anti-drug campaigns, aren't messaged properly and end up being ridiculed or ignored by their audience.
Oh, yeah. Yes. 100 times yes to that. Unfortunately, a lot of prevention content is quite lame, just a lot of other educational content, and that's a real problem in the gaming space in particular. We're just not doing a good job at the moment to use the appeal of video games to sort of bring prevention content to the forefront of attention. It's definitely necessary, and I don't think it makes a lot of sense to make this type of content that you're talking about, which is like super cringy, and you know the kids are like, oh no, let's get that away from me. I'm never gonna listen to that. We have to tailor our communication efforts to our target audience, and so we need to change the way we do things. We have started using TikTok in prevention efforts. And we also need to start talking about how to use gaming spaces in the way they are intended to be used, and not just, you know, take something from Facebook and put a link on Discord. That's not the way we can go about preventing violent extremism.
Also, I just linked in the chat. We did some work where Nielsen provided us some data, and we found that the younger players are actually less tolerant of this generally. And tend to speak with their actions of like leaving gaming spaces or not playing them or not engaging in them. So I think that we can have a little bit of optimism that the younger people coming up maybe have some kind of resiliency that they're bringing to the table that we don't see in older.
All right. We are in the final minutes of our talk today. So please, if you have some final questions, put them in the chat. I can make sure to ask them before we end. We have another question from Chef Rao, who asked, one issue I see is that the inconsistency in moderation among games. Should big game publishers be doing more to help smaller games, trust and safety teams with this?
I think this person is my soulmate. This question. Yeah, I have been pushing for many years about consistency across the industry standards, essentially. One of the real big challenges in gaming industry as the way the industry is just set up is that everyone is in their individual silos and they have their proprietary data and they have their own shareholders and they do their own thing. I did some roundtables, as Linda mentioned at the beginning, where we talked to people at big studios, at little studios. And one of the things that really stood out to me is that everybody is doing their own thing. Everyone makes their own word list. Like, there's not even a consistent word list. And I'm like, why? And some people have subject matter experts, and some people, it's their community manager making them. And it's like, why is there such a disparity in consistency across these spaces? I don't think it's necessarily about bigger studios helping littler studios, although they do have more resources. I think it's about the industry coming together as a whole to create like one set of resources. I think that GIFCT could be a potential place for that to happen. Linda mentioned them earlier, but I think that that is a huge, huge piece that's missing and desperately needed. But it's very difficult to get everyone to the table when, you know, they're businesses and they have shareholders and proprietary data and, you know, this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah, I would agree. And there are also organizations like Tech Against Terrorism who do exactly that for social media already, right? They're helping smaller platforms with putting in place these sort of policies and these processes that you need in order to implement or to counter violent extremism on their pages. But we don't see that with gaming platforms and gaming studios yet. So this is definitely something that has already been tried in a different area and could definitely be also relevant for the gaming sphere.
This is very relevant to a question that RoxOx is asking. How have conversations been with current game developers and platforms? I can see from a consumption standpoint how they would have monetary incentives to not alienate core players.
So this year at GDC, I gave a talk that was called The Return on Investment on Trust and Safety. And the first slide opened with toxic players are not your core demographic. There is a perception, absolutely, that I am a one-woman show fighting against. I mean, I'm sure there's other people too. I understand the impression that you don't want to alienate players, but the players that you don't want to alienate are such a tiny percentage in proportion of the amount of people who are playing your games. And there's a lot of money that's actually being left on the table by allowing these spaces to fester with hateful, extremist language. How do the companies receive this? It varies greatly. Some people are super receptive. Some people are in denial. So it's really a span. And some large companies super into it and some not, some small, some not. Like, there's no real pattern. I think it just really depends on the person in decision-making power and what their opinion is. I think that the researchers here can relate and understand that facts don't always change minds. So even if I come with all the data in the world, like the links I posted earlier of the work we did in collaboration with Nielsen, that shows like there's a lot of money being left on the table that doesn't necessarily change their impression of what they think these policies might do to their bottom line.
I agree. And not to sort of defend anyone, but we also have an issue that we also have in sort of social media generally, that it's often national legislation that applies very differently depending on the country that you're talking about in terms of deleting certain content. A lot of the servers are in the US, and that's very sort of free speech. You can only delete violent content, basically, but not hateful content. You know, someone can say they're a Nazi, they can post a Hitler salute or whatever because it's not illegal there. So there's also a legal side to this. What can we delete? What is freedom of expression versus what is keeping gaming spaces safe? There's always this tension, and it plays out differently in different national contexts. And in our increasingly globalized world, and particularly in the gaming sphere, which is super international and everyone speaks English, etc., it's so difficult to sort of navigate that legal field as well. So that's one of the issues, I think.
All right. I think we're off to our last question, which will be from Therese, who asked, do you see a resemblance of the Bunch of Guys radicalization theory in gamers? Could this help to explain how seemingly lone wolf actors are radicalized when it comes to gaming?
The Bunch of Guys, if you don't know, it's a theory by Sagemann, who talks about sort of groups of people coming together, and then they sort of start a radicalization process, and it's a group process. They kind of play off of each other, and people who don't want to participate, they leave the group, and so the group keeps getting more radical. I think this is part of what we're seeing, definitely in gaming spaces, particularly because we know people leave gaming spaces when they don't like the content being shared there. So then you have a sort of self-selection into certain spaces, and yes, these group processes can then enhance, let's say, certain beliefs that you already had. They are not sanctioned, but they are applauded, right, in these type of spaces. So you feel validated, you feel a sense of belonging, identity, which Rachel already touched upon. So it's definitely part of it. I'm not sure if it explains sort of the lone actor one. That we only have like a minute left. I think that's a whole new talk on lone actors versus group processes of radicalization. But definitely, I think it applies in the online sphere as well, including in games.
What she said. Good answer.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, Linda and Rachel, for giving us some insight in your work. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. It was a lot of people, a lot of questions. I don't think I've been able to ask all the questions, but I'm sure the conversation about this will continue in our Discord server. Thank you very much. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new Discord Stage Talks, and Charlie will be back in that week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live, where you can ask the guests questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.